Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC New York Public Radio, this is The Brian Lehrer Show. I'm Brian Lehrer. This is just one segment of our show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by DataPipe Managed IT Services, delivering a comprehensive suite of managed services, including implementing, securing, and scaling applications designed for mid-market and Fortune 1000 enterprises. DataPipe.com.
Well, the new book by writer David Matthews details his experience of race as someone with a white mother and a black father and an ambiguous look that has frequently allowed him to pass as either black or white. The book is called Ace of Spades, published by Henry Holt. Another new book and DVD that's meant mostly as a resource for journalists and journalism students is called The Authentic Voice, The Best Reporting on Race and Ethnicity, published by the Columbia University Press. One of the pieces they include is an ABC 2020 report on an apparently white woman who discovered a family secret that she had some black ancestors who passed as white, and that they were related to Sally Hemings and Thomas Jefferson, no less. So with me now are the producer of that 2020 segment, Alice Pfeiffer, also an editor of The Authentic Voice, the best reporting on race and ethnicity. We'll play some clips from that 2020 piece in a little bit. And David Matthews, author of Ace of Spades, to talk about passing, the place of passing in black history, and about reporting on race. David, Alice, welcome to WNYC.
Great to be here.
Hi.
David, you adapted part of your book for a New York Times Magazine essay last month, so maybe we have some listeners who haven't seen the book yet, seen that essay called Pick One. Can you tell us that story real briefly about the school cafeteria?
Yeah, sure. It was. It's one of those rare moments that in your life that can be sort of summed up in almost a crucible. So I'd moved. I was born in the suburbs of D.C., just me and my dad. And it was pretty multiracial, and I never gave a thought about race at all. It just never occurred to me. It was sort of the post-hippies, early 70s moment when everything was okay. We moved to Baltimore, where he was from, and moved in with his mom into her senior citizen's house. And her neighborhood was right on the cusp of a traditionally black neighborhood and sort of the last really rarefied upper-middle-class white neighborhood. And I went to the school just on the white side, and the first day, the minute I walked in, kids just swarmed around me and they demanded, you know, what are you? A question that I'd never heard before. I didn't have an answer prepared. But judging from sort of the way the teachers treated the black kids and sort of the way the white kids were dressed and that they obviously had more money, by about lunchtime, I figured out that if there was one thing to be at that school, it was white. And based on sort of their avidity about it, that's what I went with.
And so there, in that case, you had to choose.
Yes. It was there was no... Are you both? You know, mixed back then wasn't an option. It was, oh, my great aunt once removed is half black, then you're black. You know, there was no sort of wiggle room for that. There was no biracial.
All right. Now let's play a couple of clips from this 2020 story. And Alice, set this up a little bit for us. This actually goes back to the late 90s, doesn't it?
Yeah. The actual story in terms of when it was broadcast, yeah. Actually, the story aired on ABC News 2020 in 2000, but the event, one of the events that we filmed was at Monticello when it was the first time that descendants of Sally Hemings and descendants of Thomas and Martha Jefferson were going to be together at their annual reunion, Jefferson annual reunion. So I don't know which clip you're coming up to, but that's what led to this story.
Good, and I'll take it from there. And so here is one of the participants at that reunion. She is Jill Atkins-Sims, and you'll hear this part of her conversation with 2020 correspondent Lynn Scher about the sense that she had that there was a secret in her family.
I thought it could be anywhere from illegitimacy to incest to prostitution to all sorts of things. You imagined the worst, as it were.
Of course, yes. Not even the relative she felt closest to, her father's mother, Ellen, would tell.
I'd say, well, was your mother born in Boston? She'd say yes. And I'd say, well, where was her mother born? And she'd just sort of pause and say, Virginia. And just look at me in a way that I knew that the discussion was closed.
The abrupt silences left Jill with a feeling of undefined shame.
There was always just a sense that you just kept your head down and low, and you didn't talk about yourself, you didn't advertise yourself in any way, and you basically hid yourself.
So after her grandmother died, Jill learned that her great-grandfather had been black and thought he was the only one since the family looked so white.
But Jill was intrigued and, following her only lead, eventually emailed Vassar College, where her great-grandmother, Anita Hemmings, the woman she'd seen only once in that fuzzy photo, had gone. The news exploded on her computer screen the next day. Anita Hemmings, according to Vassar, was the first African-American graduate of this college, although apparently for most of her college career, she passed as white.
I burst into tears when I read the email. I just was overwhelmed. I had no idea that my family had such a history.
So, must be a heavy thing for a white woman to discover this in her family history. And Jill Atkins-Sim says she burst into tears. But else, there are really two things there. One is that she discovered this part of her heritage. The other is that these ancestors had passed.
Yes, her great-grandparents, Anita and Andrew Love, in 1907, moved from Boston and decided to live the rest of their lives as white people. They actually moved to 92nd and Riverside. Dr. Andrew Love was a physician. He had a practice on Madison Avenue, so all his patients must have been white, and he lived in an all-white building on 92nd and Riverside.
And there was a historical context that the piece goes into about who passed, which African-Americans tried, why did they want to run away?
Right. There's a lot. I mean, at the time that Andrew and Anita passed, it was really a peak time for passing. And for all the horrible reasons, in terms of the racism that was so virulent in the country, lynching was at an all-time high. The Jim Crow laws were really entrenched in the South and unofficially also happening in the North. I mean, not unofficially, but not so much in the law, but in custom. So opportunities for black people were really limited, and there was tremendous danger for black people, physical danger. So there were a lot of people who made that painful choice because, passing, I learned in doing the story, could take many forms. Sometimes you stayed, in touch with your family. But in this case, Anita had very just intermittent contact with her parents.
So, David Matthews, I'm curious, were you familiar with some of that historical context? I don't mean that woman's story, but this context of passing that preceded your own experience of light-skinned ambiguity?
At the time, no. Later, I found out, but my family was sort of from that. I don't know if you're familiar with the brown paper bag test that the African American community.
I am, but
is.
Tell yeah. our listeners.
Especially around the late 19th century, around the turn of the century, early 1900s, there was sort of this unofficial caste system where the lighter skinned you were as a black person, the higher social mobility within the black culture you had. You couldn't necessarily translate that into the mainstream culture, but you were sort of the highest of the high in terms of the black American culture. And my family, my father's side of the family, which was the only side I knew, they definitely were very light-skinned. They, were colored. They didn't refer to themselves as Negro necessarily. And they definitely sort of stayed. All of their friends were light-skinned, and it was just this world that, for me, to make that extra step didn't seem like a huge step. And as it turns out, it was a canyon. But at the time, I just thought, well, you guys are all sort of hanging out with people who look like you, and I look a little bit more like my white friends, so I'm just going to go over here. Of course, my dad was a black nationalist, which didn't go over well with him.
And for you, according to your book, not just your skin tone, but your identity has been kind of chameleon-like. So you write about swinging at various points in your life from virulent white racist to pontificating black militant. Is that an exaggeration?
No. As you can tell, gray is not one of my favorite colors. So I was a polemic, a living polemic. In Baltimore, oddly, if you were white, you had sort of the best of every world in terms of economic, educational, sort of the benevolent stares of shopkeepers and policemen, but you were also preyed upon to a large extent by the black population because you were viewed as having money if you were white. So oddly, I put myself in a more physical danger by being one of the white kids, but I felt like the trade-off to be part of sort of a culture that I knew from watching TV and watching the houses of my friends that didn't look like the house I lived in. You know, they had full refrigerators and cars and things that I could only dream about.
So you identified with one group at some time and other groups, the other group at the other time, to the point of being hostile to
yes,
the other?
Absolutely. I mean, there's an episode in the book that I'm obviously not proud of and I probably will get a lot of flack for, but at the height of it, I actually burned a cross with one of my white friends because we just felt so isolated and so almost hopeless in terms of, you know, we had each been mugged several times, taunted on the way to and from school, and we really felt like prisoners. And we could think of no outlet for this except for this thing, you know? And then I found out later in the course of writing my book that my dad had, like, organized protests and been friends with Malcolm X, and his father had worked with Walter White, the mythic leader of the NAACP at the turn of the century. And so it was all sort of, you know, I couldn't have...
So here you are, a kid whose white mother had abandoned you. You never really knew her. And being raised by a black father, but you burned a cross.
Yes, yeah. He didn't know about it. The first he knew about it was when he read the book. But then later, as I began to realize that race, you know, when I left the country, I realized that race probably was a little more fluid than I thought. So I swung the pendulum the other way as soon as I got back to America. And I thought, you know what, I'm a proud black nationalist, and I started watching Tony Brown's Journal and listening to Public Enemy. And then, you know, every evil done on earth was the white man's fault. I think I found an equilibrium at this point.
David Matthews' book, if you're just joining us, and maybe you saw the excerpt in the New York Times recently, called Pick One in the magazine section. The book is called Ace of Spades. He's with us along with Alice Pfeiffer, who teaches at the Columbia Graduate School of Journalism and is one of the editors of a wonderful new resource for journalists and journalism students that they released called The Authentic Voice, The Best Reporting on Race and Ethnicity, published by the Columbia University Press. And we're talking with her mostly about one of the stories in that book, which was an ABC 2020 segment on this family where there was also racial ambiguity and where there was passing. We will open up the phones now for your passing stories. Anybody have experience like David Matthews with skin color ambiguous enough, but you are African-American or at least partly so, that you have made a conscious decision at any time to pass as white? I guess kind of like coming out, you know, you don't always, there's no one act of coming out and then you're done. You can pass in some situations and
right,
not in others. Or similar stories to that we heard in the clips of people from another time and under other social circumstances from your family some time ago that may have been passed down to you. Tell us your passing stories at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. David, in your writing, you use many words and phrases to describe skin color.
Mm-hmm.
Hued like weak coffee, milky versus swarthy, blacks who range from butterscotch to Belgian chocolate. You describe yourself at one point as a yellowed freak. So it's not all about black and white, is it?
No, but oddly, the context of Baltimore, which I think, you know, the reason I think Baltimore was so useful to me is that it represents so much of what mainstream America is. It's industrial, it's not industrial, it's north, it's south, all at the same time. It hasn't been as much of a melting pot in terms of there's no large Hispanic population. So in some ways, it's sort of this America that doesn't exist anymore, but this large pocket of America that still does. So there really was no other option for me. So yellow to me was just a mitigated form of blackness or a sullied form of whiteness. That was the only way I could view it at the time.
What's your experience of white privilege? Because if you can pass for white but also experience being black, I imagine you see it in a different way and you have it sometimes.
I'm glad you brought that up because I think that's the most important facet of the book that people, you know, you can sort of attach a passing, you know, hook to it, like, oh, it's about passing and isn't this sort of quaint and this doesn't really happen anymore or does it need to? And that's almost a tangent to the notion that there is a white privilege that's almost, it's imperceptible if you're white. And that's the thing that even to this day, even, you know, getting on the subway every day or getting a cab every day, I'm able to sort of observe and reap the benefits of, but also understand that it is a benefit and that it's something that I shouldn't just take for granted and think that everyone else around me has, because I'm privy to lots of conversations in, you know, I live in New York, and it is not the liberal bastion that you would think, and very few places are.
What do you hear?
I've heard from several girls, I hate to bring up dating, but it was going to come up. I've heard from several girls that that even though I'm Jewish, Jewish girls especially, that even though I'm Jewish technically,
because your mother was Jewish,
they could never bring me home to meet their families. And I said, why? And they were like, well, black trumps Jewish. Sorry. They're like, you could have, you know, Pesach, you could have the long coat, it would not matter. And I found that really interesting, that even now, that's still kind of a trump card. Or places where I've worked, where the hiring practices, and I'd be like, I'd say, well, I'm the only black person here. Of course, that would get a laugh, and everyone would say, well, you're not all that black. But they'd say, well, we just don't get any applicants. And I, you know, part of me would be incredulous. I'm like, is that really possible in a city of 60-something percent people of color that there's no one qualified but me marginally?
And Alice, you have a psychologist in your piece who talks about the psychological challenges for blacks who pass. What did you focus on there?
Well, Dr. Elaine Pinderhughes is a noted family therapist, and she's a black woman who is, you know, has a particular expertise about black families. And she talks about the, you know, the impact of passing on families, the sense of, it's actually very complex, but very often there's a feeling of betrayal by the families, the people who are left behind. But there are other instances where people, the parents will help someone pass, especially in the past, because they wanted their children to have all the privileges, all the opportunities that white people had. So there was a sense of, well, I'll help my child get over on the white man, and we'll sneak our visits. We'll work it out somehow. In Elaine Pinderhughes' case, actually, her mother just passed on a daily basis during the Depression. Elaine was living in Washington, D.C., where she was brought up. Her father was a dentist. During the Depression, people didn't have money to go to the dentist. The family was in financial trouble. Her mother looked white, got a job with the government, was paid more because they thought she was white. So her black husband would drop her 3 or 4 blocks from the office and pick her up. And I'm sure that was very hard on her. She probably heard all kinds of unvarnished racism. Yet Elaine once told me that she felt very proud, on the other hand, that she helped save the family financially. So there's so many nuances and complexities.
And conflicts and areas of psychological dissonance for people doing things like that. We'll continue in a minute. We have a lot of calls coming in, so I'll take some of your passing stories, continue to talk about what this really means historically and in social context today even, and get into some of the journalism questions. How do you report a story like this so that it's a public service and not just something sensational? Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. We are talking about passing. Light-skinned African Americans who can always or at times get by as white, and when and why they choose to or choose not to in different times in history and different circumstances today. David Matthews, who has that experience, is the author of a brand new book called Ace of Spades. And Alice Pfeiffer, who used to produce for ABC 2020 and now is at the Columbia Graduate School of Journalism and editor of a book called The Authentic Voice, The Best Reporting on Race and Ethnicity. One of the examples in there is an old 2020 story about passing. Our phone number, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or email brianlehrershow@wnyc.org. And Claire in the Bronx, you're on WNYC. Hi, Claire.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Wow, I'm really surprised by this, talking about what you're talking about on the radio, because I haven't heard anybody talk about this in a while. But my mother and my father are both half white and half black, and we would move a lot around a lot all over New York State, and we moved to this one small it wasn't a small town, but it was a decent-sized town in upstate New York, and most of the kids in the school were pretty much all white. And me and my brothers and sisters were the only people of color at the school, and so they made the school they declared the school a school of diversity, and they like used us as poster children for the school. You know, that school was had black kids come to the school, and they were diverse and all types of things. And it came to the point where me and my brother and sisters used to say, well, both our parents are half white and half black, so we're 100% white and 100% black.
And what was the experience like for you? Could people tell that you were something other than all white?
Yeah, a lot of people actually thought we were Spanish because just the way we look, because we're like yellow. And it was really complicated for a while because we didn't know what to tell people. Like, it was so difficult to explain, well, my mother is Italian and Haitian, and my father is African-American and Pennsylvania Dutch. And it's like, it was kind of ridiculous after a while. And we got pushed from both sides. Like, the white people didn't want to hang out with us because we looked like the kind of like the black and Spanish kids, and the black kids didn't want to hang out with us because they said we talked like white people. So... It was kind of ridiculous.
Sound a little familiar there, David?
Yeah. Minus the Spanish part, because again, there were no Hispanic people where I grew up, but it was definitely that sort of getting tugged up from both ends.
Thank you, Claire. Alan in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Alan.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I identified with the woman on the TV special who discovered that she had black ancestors. My mother is from New Orleans, and this kind of thing is actually extremely common in New Orleans. That's exactly what happened with my family, is that they decided to pass over from being... I mean, they identified themselves as mixed. They didn't consider themselves black or white. They considered themselves mixed, but, you know, the outside society considered them black, and they decided that they would prefer to be white, so they passed over. But we didn't know this, so...
How'd you find out?
Well, you know, like that woman who was interviewed, my brother and I, we always had a sense that there was something missing that we didn't know. And then my great-aunt...
Just like the story in the piece, that she sensed that there was a family secret.
Oh, yeah. We knew there was something. We couldn't quite place it. And my grandmother died when I was very young, but my great-aunt, who was like a second grandmother, when she died several years ago, or rather right before she died, she revealed everything to my mother. Uh-huh. And it was a shock, but it was not a surprise. And it was most of all a sort of a relief.
Yeah. Alan, thank you. Janice in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Janice.
Hi, Brian. Yes, excuse me. My story is quickly twofold. One has to do with my grandmother. I'm from Seattle. My grandmother was always mistaken for white, and during the 1930s and 40s, she used that to help integrate housing. And so she would, you know, pose as being a white person wanting to buy a house. And I think it was for the Urban League or one of the organizations there.
And once she had it, she outed herself, but she already had it, so she had integrated it. Oh, well, if she was buying a house.
Well, she would be prospecting for a house under the guise of looking for a house.
Right.
And finally, she integrated her own neighborhood when she was the first black family to buy the house. The realtor thought she was white. And then after she signed the papers, her very dark-skinned husband, my grandfather, and all of their 8 beautiful brown children came marching through. And so that's one story. The other story is that her baby brothers... unfortunately went the other way. They became merchant marine, and they passed for white. And I believe, you know, they rose through the ranks and traveled around the world. And I believe that had a major impact on their lives and how they led their lives, because they had to hide. They pretended. My Uncle Jimmy, who I love deeply, had a lifelong drinking problem. And But they were very smart, and they did not want to be relegated to the galley, where all black, you know, people were at that time if you worked for the Merchant Marine.
And so are you at all angry at him for or at them for passing?
Absolutely not. My Uncle Jimmy was the dearest, dearest man, and he used his anger when he would come home every 5 years or so to Seattle, and he would talk to me about race. And we are descended of abolitionists who were from Scotland. And so that is my grandmother's great-great-grandfather. His name was Lewis Clark. And so there was always this issue of color on my mother's side. Mm. Her ancestors originally were from Kentucky. And a man from Scotland fought in the American Revolution, came home, wanted to marry. I mean, the war was over. He married a biracial woman, and hence us. And they married under the under the belief that their children would be free. And after the slave master died,
right.
And the master died, and the master's family violated the will and destroyed it and sold everybody down into slavery.
Like that. Thank you for your call, Janice. What a story. What a set of stories.
Yeah.
Really.
Alice, your book is a resource for journalists and journalism students by focusing on quality examples of reporting about race. What was the public service dimension that you were trying to achieve by reporting on this story? Something beyond, I'm sure, just the sensationalist value of talking about this woman with this curious mixed blood history.
Well, I think it was very clear to me that Jill's family story, is not just one isolated, you know, fascinating tale. You know, a family secret, the theme of family secret is universal. Families have all kinds of secrets, so there's that. But this was a microcosm. Her story is a microcosm of that carries so much of America's racial history in it. And a lot of the painful parts of America's racial history. So that I thought was important. But to broadcast and to have as many people see as possible, to understand our country better racially. But also, I thought for black viewers, I also wanted them to see what they knew about, to have acknowledgement of what they've been experiencing, hearing about the cousin who disappeared and never was heard from again. And also to educate white people who didn't know about it.
So, David, do you see your book as serving different purposes for white readers and for black readers?
I guess primarily I see. I mean, to me, it's more like in the tradition of, you know, This Boy's Life, or it's just a sort of coming of age tale. But on the racial aspect of it, I think it's more of showing white people that. Just because you don't think someone of color is in the room with you doesn't necessarily mean that you can say anything that you want. And it's sort of a way to check how far we've actually come. I feel like a spy in some ways. You know, I'm sort of in these parlor rooms and I'm getting the unfiltered, you know, these aren't the blue-collar rednecks that you would think. I'm getting sort of the rarefied air, and it's still kind of smoggy in there. So I'm kind of bringing that message back. And then for black people, I hope I'm relaying the message that, yeah, you know, this isn't over yet. You know, that you know it, like that people that I talk to or from my old hometown, they know that things are, my dad has a famous saying, he's like, things are maybe 30% better than they were during the civil rights movement, which isn't great. So it's sort of a message that, look, this isn't over yet, and not everyone has forgotten.
And when we were talking off the air, you were mentioning how you had this writing career that wasn't going anywhere, and then your agent or someone discovered that you had this mixed race history and you could pass as either, and you had all these stories to tell, and said, well, why don't you write your memoir? And now here you are with an actual book coming out. So you talked about white privilege. Is that an instance, or are there any instances in your experience of black privilege, even though it wouldn't be the predominant thing in America?
No. I mean, I've never had a benefit from being black other than sort of self-awareness, a rich legacy of history and culture that I never would have had. But I can't think of a benefit to it other than, you know, again, once you get to the coast, the L.A. and the New York and D.C. sort of exotica. I'm treated as sort of an interesting flavor sometimes because of it. But I wouldn't say that's a benefit necessarily.
But that can be an objectification, a dehumanization.
Sure, absolutely. You know, it's I'm a curio as opposed to a person. And, oh, that must be so fascinating. And I'm like, well, wait till you get to Chapter 9 of my book and you tell me if you'd like to trade places for a week or two.
What happens in Chapter 9?
You know, I just picked that number out of the air. I don't remember what happens in Chapter 9, but there's some pretty heavy stuff that happens in there. There were some instances of near violence and, you know, there, especially as you get older around dating, that's where things, I think that's where race really comes into it's going to be decided there. When you start dating people and they don't know your race, that can get tricky.
Let's take a few more passing stories from our callers, and then we're going to go on to talk about really something else relevant to Black history, how the praise that Joe Biden thought he was lavishing on Barack Obama yesterday was actually an insult in historical terms. We'll talk about that with Daily News columnist Errol Lewis, who also got to sit in on a focus group, which indicates that Hillary Clinton may not have much home field advantage here in New York State when running against Barack Obama and John Edwards, but that's coming up in a few. James in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, James.
Hey, how are you?
All right, and you?
Well, I'm well. I'm California raised, middle class. My parents were both military, and my father was very strict. So all my playmates and my classmates were not Black. I'm Black. I'm very Black-looking, in a sense. So my skill set was somewhat white, which helped me get up through the corporate arena, and I was actually ridiculed by the Blacks for trying to pass, and I puzzled the whites, and it put me in a really strange position. So then all of a sudden I lost my job, I moved to the East Coast, and I'm just entrenched with all these Black faces, and it was rich and it was wonderful, but there's a lot of suspicion and people don't really embrace me, and I'm trying to find my new path. And it's just an unusual place to be. And I read this gentleman's article. I have it in my bag. I just read it last week, and it made me giggle about the cafeteria story, because I thought that could be me just trying to figure out which way to go. And I wanted to speak to what he said about the benefits of being Black. One of the benefits of my Blackness, though, being here on the East Coast, is that the more upwardly mobile Blacks do identify that I'm trying to do something or be something more than what is expected, and that has definitely helped me as a support group. So that has changed, where on the West Coast I really didn't have that support from the Blacks. So
really interesting.
Yes, so that's where I am now, and I'm
James,
comedy, it is helping me, and writing, and I hope to write my own story one day.
Good. Well, when you do that, give us a call. Thanks, and call us anyway between now and then. But Grace in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC.
Hi, Brian. My family history has that problem on both sides. I have a great uncle on my father's side who joined the Navy, as your previous caller said, joined the Merchant Marines. Uncle Jason Brooks, he disappeared. He went to California. The last we heard was somewhere in the 40s. And
when you say disappeared, you mean when he decided to pass as white, he just left his Black family behind?
Exactly. He left the family behind. We never heard anything except for a few letters over the years, but basically we never saw him again.
That's such an, obviously a sad and tragic thing. And Alice, it comes up, and we're almost out of time, but it comes up in the story in your piece, in that this couple that was passing in New York had to sneak visits. They didn't cut off their families entirely, but they had to sneak visits with their observably Black families. And so it made for this, you know, they may have been doing well for themselves economically and socially as a result, but what a price.
Yeah, and one quick point that just comes to the core of the kind of tensions and pain it can cause. At one point, Anita had her mother visit from Boston, but she had her use the servant's entrance because it was an all-white building, and she, you know, thought she might lose the apartment if she had her come in the front way. But also, then, according to Jill, her Anita's sister was furious with her for having made their mother use the servant's entrance.
Yeah. Alice Pfeiffer is co-editor of The Authentic Voice, the best reporting on race and ethnicity, published by the Columbia University Press. They also have a website, by the way, which is wonderful and has a lot of resources for journalists and journalism students and would be of interest to others too, called theauthenticvoice.org. David Matthews is the author of the brand new book called Ace of Spades, published by Henry Holt. Been great to have both of you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we'll talk about that Biden-Obama thing and other presidential politics in a minute. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Thanks for listening to The Brian Lehrer Show from WNYC New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.